Hey everyone, Alex Vanderbilt here, your guide for today's deep dive into the stories shaping our world.
And I'm Sam Astor, ready to help connect the dots and explore the deeper implications of today's headlines.
Today, we are taking a truly comprehensive, exhaustive, and detailed deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025.
That's right.
Our mission, as always, is to unpack the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from the stack of sources you've shared with us.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as your shortcut to being incredibly well-informed, complete with, you know, surprising facts and just enough humor to keep you hooked.
We hope so.
We'll be discussing and debating the impact and implications of each and every article, making sure you walk away with a richer understanding of what's truly going on.
Absolutely. We're looking at a fascinating array of topics today, really spanning from the complex dynamics of financial markets and geopolitical shifts.
Big shifts.
Two very personal stories that truly reflect the current American experience. Our goal is to move beyond the surface-level reporting and help you understand not just what's happening, but critically, why it matters.
The why. Always important.
Encouraging a thoughtful and critical perspective as we navigate this, well, sea of information together.
All right, let's unpack this right from the front page because this headline immediately grabs your attention. Stocks are now pricier than they were in the dot-com era.
Oof. Yeah, that gets your attention.
For anyone with an investment portfolio or just an interest in the economy, hearing dot-com era and pricier in the same sentence can definitely send a shiver down your spine.
It really can. Makes you think.
The article lays out some pretty compelling figures. The S&P 500 has not just hit a record high. Its current valuation, specifically its price-to-sales ratio, is at an all-time record. 3.23 times sales, I think it's at.
An all-time record, yeah. And the price-to-earnings ratio, looking ahead 12 months, is 22.5 times. That's way higher than the average of, what, 16.8 times since 2000? Significantly higher. But here's where it gets really interesting, and perhaps a bit concerning. The market concentration.
Ah, yes. The big players.
The 10 largest companies in the S&P 500 now account for almost 40%, 39.5% to be exact, of its total value. That is the most ever.
Wow. Almost 40%.
Out of those 10, 9 of them are trillion-dollar market cap giants. 9.
A key aspect to highlight here is the comparison to the dot-com era. Because while the valuations are indeed extreme by many measures, the underlying story might be different.
How so?
Well, during the dot-com bubble, many companies had little to no actual revenue, let alone profit, right?
Yeah.
Today, however, many investors argue that these mega-cap tech companies, think NVIDIA, think Microsoft, are genuinely boosting sales and profits at a rapid, even accelerating pace.
So real earnings, not just hype.
That's the argument. But it brings up a crucial question.
Yeah.
Is this a sustainable fundamental growth driven by profound innovation? Or are we, despite the stronger fundamentals, still inflating another bubble? Maybe one built on a much narrower foundation.
Steve Sosnick, chief strategist at Interactive Brokers, he articulates this concern about market concentration perfectly. He asks, if everyone is effectively long the same things, where do the marginal buyers come from when they fall?
That's a really good question. Like, who steps in?
Exactly. It's a valid point about liquidity and support, suggesting that if these giants falter, the impact could be widespread and severe, given how much of the market is tied to their performance.
That's a critical question, particularly when you consider how much of the market's performance now hinges on this small group, often dubbed the Magnificent Seven.
Right.
But the article also offers an important counter perspective, reminding us that not everything in the market is experiencing these extreme valuations.
Okay, so there's nuance.
Definitely. In fact, if you look at the average company in the S&P 500, weighted equally rather than by market capitalization, it trades at a lower price-to-sales ratio, actually below the market cap weighted index, 1.76 times sales, I believe.
Interesting. So the average stock isn't quite as stratospheric.
Exactly. Mark Jambrone, head of U.S. equities at Barrow Hanley Global Investors, suggests there are attractive opportunities beyond these mega-cap tech names. He says parts are even below average to some degree.
So where are they looking?
His firm is specifically looking for businesses that can leverage artificial intelligence for productivity gains, but without the, you know, extreme valuations currently commanded by the pure play AI companies.
Smart. Getting the benefit without paying the huge premium.
Right. He's quite skeptical that the current valuations for the largest companies can be maintained long term, noting that expectations are getting to be so dramatic, it will be very hard to meet them.
That makes sense. It's hard to keep exceeding sky-high expectations forever. The core insight here then is that while the S&P 500's headline numbers suggest a booming market, it's a boom built on a narrow foundation of a few tech giants.
Right, very narrow.
This means the overall market is more vulnerable to shifts in those specific companies. And for the individual investor, maybe true opportunities lie in the less hyped, equally weighted segments, especially those poised to benefit from AI integration without the current hypervaluations.
So what does this all mean for you, the individual investor, or simply someone trying to understand the economy? Are you looking beyond the dominant headlines and exploring those below-average opportunities that GM Brown talks about?
You know, perhaps in sectors that could leverage AI without the associated hypervaluations.
Or is the gravitational pull of the dominant players, with their seemingly unstoppable momentum, simply too strong to resist? Is the focus still on what's already proven, but maybe overextended?
It's a crucial decision point in today's market, isn't it? And how you navigate it could significantly impact your portfolio. It really requires careful thought.
From your investment portfolio, let's shift our focus now to the Federal Reserve, because their actions are incredibly far-reaching. They directly impact everything from your mortgage rates to business loans and job markets.
Absolutely central.
The headline, Fed Upheaval Sows New Uncertainty About Path of Rates, tells us something very big is brewing.
Uh-huh. Upheaval is a strong word.
It is. We're on the cusp of what's likely to be the Fed's first interest rate cut of the year, a quarter point reduction from the current 4.25%, 4.5% target range, most likely happening in September.
That's been widely expected for a while now.
Yes, but the article reveals that President Trump's unprecedented efforts to reshape the central bank are completely scrambling the dynamics around this. It's getting complicated.
How so? What's happening?
Well, the administration moved to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook over allegations of mortgage fraud. This is completely unprecedented in the Fed's 111-year history.
Firing a Fed governor? Wow, that's extraordinary.
It is, and Cook has, in turn, sued to block her removal. So her ability to actually vote at the September meeting is uncertain, and it's undeniably straining internal Fed unity.
I can imagine. That must create incredible tension.
On top of that, Trump also nominated close advisor Steven Mnuchin to an open seat on the board. Now, this move could potentially give his appointees a 4-3 majority if Cook is ultimately fired and Mnuchin is confirmed.
A 4-3 majority appointed by the current president, that's a tectonic shift, isn't it? The independence of the Federal Reserve is almost sacrosanct, a cornerstone of its function and credibility.
It's meant to be.
While a September rate cut still seems all but assured for now, the article highlights that the breadth of support for it and, crucially, the path afterward are deeply in doubt.
Right. What happens next?
Exactly. This isn't just about a single vote or a particular interest rate decision. It's about the very credibility and future direction of monetary policy itself.
And we're seeing this reflected elsewhere, too, right?
Yes. We also see this political tension reflected in the opinion section with an article titled, Suddenly the Democrats Want an Independent Fed. It reflects on the politicization of the central bank from various angles.
Kind of reminds us that concerns about Fed independence aren't entirely new.
True. But the brazenness of the current situation, with direct challenges to governors and clear political pressure on rate decisions, that feels significant. It's pushing the boundaries of what has been considered acceptable.
And the stakes couldn't be higher for the economy. Fed Chair Jerome Powell's role is typically to forge consensus among the Federal Open Market Committee members.
He's usually been pretty successful at that.
Right. The article notes his tenure has seen only 18 dissents in 661 policy votes, a testament to that consensus building skill.
Very few dissents.
But now, with a potentially divided board looming, that dynamic could change dramatically. We're seeing arguments both for and against rate cuts.
Like who?
For instance, Kansas City Fed President Jeffrey Schmid maintains that inflation remains too high, suggesting a cautious approach to avoid reigniting price pressures.
Okay, the inflation hawk view.
Yet there's also the potential for a more aggressive half-point cut, which could be pushed by Trump appointees like Michelle Bowman or Christopher Waller, especially with the president openly advocating for lower rates.
So real division on the path forward.
And what's also notable is that Powell himself seems to have shifted his perception of risk. He's now seeing a weaker labor market following those seismic downward revisions to job creation in early August.
Ah, the jobs numbers were revised down quite a bit.
They were. Huh. So this new data strengthens the case for a rate adjustment, but the political maneuvering adds a huge layer of complexity.
The broader implications of this uncertainty within the Fed can translate directly to your household budget, can't they?
Absolutely.
Well, what does a Federal Reserve, potentially subject to political pressures rather than purely economic data, mean for your mortgage rates, your ability to borrow for a car or business, or even your job security as businesses react?
Big question.
And if the Fed's independence becomes consistently undermined, leading to monetary policy decisions that are seen as politically motivated, what does that do to global confidence in the U.S. economy?
Yeah, the global view is critical, too.
It's a fundamental challenge to the institution designed to provide stability, and its ramifications could touch every aspect of our financial lives.
Beyond the high-level market and Fed news, there's a deeply personal story unfolding across America, one captured by the headline, Americans Lose Faith, that hard work leads to economic gains.
Yeah, I saw that one. It's sobering.
Yeah, this one really hits home for a lot of people, pointing to a significant and, frankly, troubling shift in national sentiment.
What are the specifics?
A new Wall Street Journal NRRC poll reveals a record low. Only 25% of people believe they have a good chance of improving their standard of living. That's the lowest since 1987.
Only a quarter.
Wow. More than three quarters lack confidence that the next generation will be better off. And alarmingly, nearly 70% believe the American dream, that classic idea that hard work leads to getting ahead, no longer holds true or never did.
70%. That's a profound statement about the national mood, especially when other economic indicators might appear, you know, positive on the surface.
Okay.
What's particularly striking here is the disconnect. Traditional economic measures often paint a picture of a robust economy. Maybe low unemployment, stock market gains.
Right. The numbers look okay sometimes.
Yet public sentiment is clearly sour. This very problem, the article notes, bedeviled former President Joe Biden and contributed to his party's loss.
It's a tough puzzle.
Neil Mahoney, a Stanford economist, calls the gap between these quantitative metrics and qualitative sentiment staggering. He notes that the stock market boom hasn't translated into stronger public sentiment this time around.
Why not?
He suggests fears about the future are a key factor, extending beyond immediate inflation concerns, which still remain sticky. 28% cite inflation as a major financial strain. This hints at a deeper pervasive anxiety that purely quantitative economic data isn't fully capturing.
The poll really brings this to life through individual stories, which helps us understand the human impact of these trends. It's not just numbers.
Who did they talk to?
Take Jeff Lindley, a 61-year-old real estate appraiser in Texas. He sees the economy improving overall, but for his adult children, despite their best efforts, they're unable to afford homes. Two of them are currently living back with him.
That's tough. A real generational contract.
He vividly recalls being able to support his family on one income and build houses, a stark contrast to his children's current struggles.
Yeah.
Or consider Bill Sanchez, 30, an Army veteran and criminal defense attorney in Pennsylvania. Even making $72,000 annually, he feels there are limits to what hard work can actually bring people these days.
Even with a good income, that feeling of limitation.
And even those doing relatively well are not immune to this insecurity. Christina Stevens, a 46-year-old tech worker in Washington, mentors early career workers who are, in her words, defeated with high costs and a challenging job market. She notes, rents are sky high. Inflation is killing us.
And she feels it herself.
Yes. She herself feels no one is safe and is actively networking on LinkedIn just to keep her options open.
Wow. Constant vigilance.
Then there's Christopher Kischel, 40, and his wife in Atlanta. They make a combined $350,000 annually. Pretty comfortable, right?
Yep, think so.
They paused their search for a bigger home to expand their family because giving up their existing 2.5% mortgage rate would literally double their monthly housing spend.
Ah, the golden handcuffs of low mortgage rates. That's a big factor.
He perfectly encapsulates the feeling, saying you could be comfortable, but not where you want to be.
That really sums it up for a lot of people, doesn't it? Carlin Bowman from the American Enterprise Institute offers a macro perspective, suggesting Americans have been buffeted by a triple whammy: the financial crisis, COVID, persistent inflation, labor market concerns, and tariffs, all contributing to this pervasive sense of insecurity.
A lot hitting at once.
These individual stories truly underscore the broad and deeply personal impact of these economic anxieties. We also see fears about job security, particularly with the accelerating rise of artificial intelligence.
AI is definitely a growing concern.
Jerry Esch, 56, for example, was laid off from Microsoft after 20 years, where he was making $200,000 a year. Now he's deeply worried about AI's impact on the broader labor market and his own future.
After 20 years.
Oh, that's rough.
His son-in-law, Austin Odell, 35, despite having an MBA and making $120,000 in his last job, still didn't feel secure and was laid off before he could pay off his accumulated debt.
MBA, good salary. Still not secure.
These anecdotes illustrate that even a high income or a solid career path no longer guarantees the traditional sense of economic security that many Americans once took for granted.
It feels different now.
The profound implication here is that when the traditional pathways to economic security feel blocked, and even high earners feel insecure, it creates a sense of systemic vulnerability that ripples through society.
So this raises an important question for all of us. When the traditional pathways to economic security feel blocked, and even high earners feel insecure, what does this mean for the fabric of our society? How are you navigating these anxieties, both personally and within your community? And what do you believe is truly needed to restore faith in economic mobility for future generations? It speaks to a deeper societal shift beyond just the numbers.
Moving from these personal economic anxieties to national policy, President Trump's tariff agenda continues to reshape industries and spark significant legal battles. It's a major theme.
Definitely a defining feature of his approach.
We're seeing American-made businesses are clamoring to get on this tariff list, running parallel with a major Supreme Court showdown that could redefine presidential power itself.
Two sides of the same coin, really. The policy and the legal challenge.
The Commerce Department recently added tariffs on over 400 products. It's a wide range from everyday items like flatware and kettlebells to heavy machinery like bulldozers and industrial robots.
Under what authority?
These particular tariffs are imposed under a national security rationale, specifically Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. That scene is more durable and less susceptible to legal challenge than some other types of tariffs.
Ah, the Section 232 national security argument.
For some, this is a real lifeline. Greg Owens, co-founder of Sherrill Manufacturing, America's last stainless steel flatware maker, actually celebrated a 50% tariff on imported flatware. He genuinely hopes it gives his business a fighting chance after years struggling against cheaper imports.
A chance to compete? I can see why they'd want that.
Similarly, George Boyd Jr., CEO of Golden's Foundry and Machine, successfully petitioned to include dumbbells and kettlebells, and he's now actively looking for more products to get tariff protection.
So companies are actively lobbying for these tariffs.
They are. Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management, estimates these August tariffs alone apply to about $164 billion of imported goods.
$164 billion? That's a significant amount of trade. What's particularly striking here is how companies are now actively seeking protectionist tariffs, almost creating what Scott Linsicum of the Cato Institute describes as a tariff buffet.
A tariff buffet.
Yeah.
Interesting phrase.
While these tariffs are clearly intended to boost domestic manufacturing, the opinion section offers a critical counter perspective in an article titled, "Trump Isn't a Tariff King."
Okay, what's the counter?
It highlights a significant development. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit just ruled 7-4 against Trump's broader global tariffs, the ones previously imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA.
The IEEPA tariffs. Mm-hmm. Those were controversial.
Very. This act is typically used for emergency economic sanctions, and the court argued it doesn't explicitly grant the president the power to impose broad tariffs like these. They distinguished regulate from tax.
A key legal distinction.
Yet another opinion piece, why the Supreme Court could uphold Trump's tariffs, offers a counterpoint. It argues that presidential powers are often at their strongest in foreign policy and national security, where Congress traditionally grants broader authority.
So maybe the Supreme Court will see it differently?
Possibly. It reminds us that previous presidents, like Richard Nixon, have also leveraged tariffs unilaterally, suggesting there's historical precedent for executive action in this realm. So we have the significant tension between judicial and executive interpretations of power.
Setting the stage for a major constitutional clash.
Exactly.
That tension is definitely leading to a high-stakes legal battle, one with profound implications for how future presidents can wield economic power. The appeals court ruling has given the president until mid-October to appeal to the Supreme Court.
So the clock is ticking.
It is. The administration is clearly banking on the high court's conservative majority, which has often granted preliminary relief in other Trump administration cases, to affirm executive power, particularly in foreign policy.
What's the core legal issue?
A central legal concept here is the major questions doctrine. It essentially demands that if a government agency or the executive branch claims a new significant power, like imposing widespread tariffs, the power must have been very clearly and explicitly granted by Congress, not just implied.
So Congress has to be crystal clear.
It forces the question. Does simply regulating imports under IEP truly give the president the power to impose broad tariffs when Congress typically delegates tariff authority in much clearer specific terms?
A fundamental question about separation of powers.
Meanwhile, these tariffs aren't just affecting big industries. They're hitting individual consumers too, often in surprising ways.
How so?
The article, A Guide to Shopping Online After De Minimis Tariff Rule Ends, explains that tariffs will now apply to all e-commerce packages, not just those from China.
Ah, the end of the de minimis rule. That's good for online shoppers.
It is. That rule previously allowed low-value imported packages to enter the U.S. without tariffs, but now those exemptions are gone. This means prices could rise, or your options might shrink for items from French apparel to Italian sneakers, even American brands shipping from overseas factories.
So that cheap gadget from overseas might not be so cheap anymore.
Exactly. Consumers might even have to pay tariff at delivery or potentially refuse packages, leading to logistical headaches for everyone.
That sounds like a mess.
We hear the story of Dustin Fontaine, founder of the German watch brand Sternglass. He actually paused U.S. sales entirely, losing a quarter of his revenue, and is now contemplating setting up a U.S. corporation just to navigate this new, more complicated landscape.
Wow. Pause sales completely. The profound implication here is that this Supreme Court decision could redefine the balance of power in trade policy for generations to come and directly impact the concept of American economic freedom and consumer choice.
It's a landmark case, potentially.
So what does this all mean for your wallet and your shopping habits? You might suddenly find your favorite foreign-made items more expensive or harder to acquire, directly experiencing the ripple effects of these trade policies.
And as the Supreme Court is forced to confront one of the boldest claims of presidential power in recent history.
How might this decision redefine the balance of power in trade policy for generations to come? And indeed, the very concept of American economic freedom and consumer choice. The outcome will have far-reaching implications beyond just the current administration's agenda.
While the U.S. grapples with its own tariff policies and these internal legal battles, the global stage is witnessing a dramatic reshaping of alliances. It's not happening in a vacuum.
No, definitely not. The world is reacting.
The headline, Chinese, Russian, Indian leaders pledge cooperation in a message to Trump, signals a significant shift in the world order. It's truly like a geopolitical chess game, and President Trump is certainly a central player whose moves have ripple effects.
A very active player, yes.
The leaders of China, Russia, and India recently held a unity-focused summit in Tianjin, China. It also included other nations like Iran and Pakistan.
Pride gathering.
This event was widely interpreted as a direct message to President Trump, whose unorthodox approach, for example, his 50% tariffs on India for buying Russian oil, is seen by some analysts as actually pushing India closer to Russia and warming its relations with China, rather than isolating Russia as intended.
So potentially having the opposite effect.
That's the argument. The summit served as almost a haka, you know, the Maori ritual of challenge and unity, before the real contest of trade negotiations.
A symbolic display of unity against U.S. pressure.
Right. Russia's Vladimir Putin's prominent presence, along with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un unexpected at a military parade, clearly underscores the challenges to Trump's attempts to redraw the world order and flip adversaries.
This brings up a crucial point. Is Trump's reverse Kissinger strategy, which famously aimed to pry Moscow away from Beijing, actually having the opposite effect? Is it fostering a stronger anti-Western alliance?
That's the big question, isn't it?
The article, Trump's Defining Issue, China, from the opinion section reinforces this. It describes Putin's presence at the Tianjin summit as a calculated move to demonstrate Trump's diplomatic failure with Moscow.
A thumb in the eye, diplomatically speaking.
And when we put this in context with the broader concern voiced in We Have Met the Enemy and He Isn't Us, from the opinion section, there's a clear call for America to focus on this external threat from China rather than continuing to be consumed by internal divisions.
Focusing outward instead of inward.
This evolving geopolitical alignment has direct implications for technology, specifically the rapidly advancing field of artificial intelligence, and how different nations envision its future.
Absolutely. The technological dimension is crucial here, revealing two very different paths to AI development. The article, China Increases Surveillance of Troubled People to Quell Rising Unrest, reveals how Beijing is intensifying its surveillance of troubled people to quell unrest.
Using technology for social control.
Yes, using a new society work agency. This agency ostensibly assists with emotional and economic setbacks, but simultaneously monitors dissatisfied individuals. Mm. Top officials in this agency are often from state security and police, and companies are even asked to monitor people.
Companies involved too.
Yes. The grid management system divides communities into sections, with grid managers gathering data and looking for security threats. This approach leverages China's vast surveillance state, facial recognition, data gathering algorithms, AI to monitor public sentiment.
Sounds very comprehensive.
They've even gone so far as to encourage gig workers to act as mobile probes to collect public opinion.
Gig workers as informants. Wow. For critics, this is absolute social control, a dystopian vision of state power.
But supporters have a different view.
Supporters argue it proactively responds to individual needs, preventing larger social problems before they escalate. It's a stark difference in philosophy.
And this emphasis on practical, state-controlled application of technology extends directly to China's broader vision for AI, doesn't it?
It does. The article, China Has a Different Vision for AI, It Might Be Smarter, details how China, led by Xi Jinping, is prioritizing practical, low-cost AI applications designed to boost efficiency and be easily marketable.
What kind of applications?
We see concrete examples like AI models for grading high school exams, improving weather forecasts, dispatching police, advising farmers, and intelligent robots in what they call dark factories, fully automated factories.
Real-world immediate uses.
Exactly. China's government is heavily investing with an $8.4 billion fund and strategically embracing open source models, which enables widespread and rapid deployment.
How's that compared to the U.S. approach?
It contrasts sharply with Silicon Valley's pursuit of artificial general intelligence, or AGI, the idea of creating AI that can perform any intellectual task a human can. AGI has seen recent setbacks, like OpenAI's GPT-5 reportedly leaving users underwhelmed.
So the U.S. focus is more ambitious, maybe less practical right now?
Arguably. Some U.S. tech leaders, like former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, are even suggesting that China's pragmatic approach might actually be smarter in the current environment, yielding more immediate and tangible results.
That's a profound divergence in technological strategy, and it's heavily influenced by the ongoing U.S.-China trade tensions, right?
Absolutely. U.S. trade restrictions, particularly on advanced semiconductors, make it difficult for Chinese AI companies to scale up the kind of advanced model training needed for an AGI-focused path.
So it gives Beijing a strong incentive to pursue this different, more application-focused and open-source-driven path.
Precisely. However, the opinion piece, export controls failed. China begs to differ, offers a counterargument. It contends that U.S. semiconductor export controls are actually working.
Oh, what's their evidence?
It states that the U.S. share of global AI computing power has increased by nearly 50%, while China's has fallen by half.
That's a significant shift, if true.
It also notes that China's Xi Jinping is deeply committed to indigenization, developing their own domestic capabilities, recognizing that dependency on foreign components is like building a house on someone else's foundation. It highlights China's long-term strategic goal of self-reliance.
Makes sense strategically.
And it's not just technology that's seeing this strategic realignment. The opinion piece, Russian Drone Parts, Made in China, highlights how China, despite its claims of neutrality, is providing components and machinery that enable Russia to produce arms for the Ukraine war.
So direct support for Russia's war effort.
The article cites over $1.9 billion in high-priority dual-use items. Goods with both civilian and military applications subject to Western sanctions imported from China in the first half of 2025.
What kind of items?
Critical components like engines for Shahed-type drones and fiber optic cable for advanced drones directly impacting the battlefield and the trajectory of the conflict.
When we put this in context, China's blend of centralized state control, a highly targeted and pragmatic approach to AI development, and its strategic alliances with nations like Russia and India presents a profound and multifaceted challenge to the existing global order.
It really does. The profound implication here is that while the West chases a distant, theoretical general intelligence, Beijing is rapidly deploying pragmatic, state-controlled AI solutions that are already reshaping its economy, surveillance capabilities, and global influence.
It's not just a different path. It's a fast track to real-world power, isn't it?
With significant implications for how technology will define human rights and international relations. What does this mean for the future of technological dominance, for human rights and individual freedoms in an increasingly surveilled society, and for the delicate balance of power in international relations for you.
It's a complex web of interconnected issues that will undoubtedly shape the global landscape for decades to come. Definitely something to keep watching closely.
While global powers jockey for position and technological supremacy, the world continues to be rocked by conflicts and humanitarian crises that demand our attention. It's easy to forget with everything else going on.
It is. From ongoing battles in Gaza and Ukraine to a devastating earthquake in Afghanistan, the headlines paint a picture of relentless turmoil.
Let's start in the Middle East. What's the latest?
Israel announced it killed Abu Obeidah, the longtime spokesman for Hamas's armed wing, in a Gaza City airstrike. This is incredibly significant because he was one of the few surviving senior Hamas leaders.
A major figure taken out. What's the context?
This comes as Israel prepares an offensive on Gaza City, believing other Hamas leaders are sheltering there. They've called up tens of thousands of reservists, signaling a major escalation.
So likely more intense fighting ahead.
Seems probable. Separately, we learn of a key Houthi leader killed in Israeli airstrike in Yemen, Prime Minister Ahmed Khalib al-Rawi.
The Houthis in Yemen?
Yeah.
They've been active against Israel, too.
Yes, as the last remaining Iranian ally actively targeting Israel after Hezbollah and Hamas have been severely weakened, they've launched drones and missiles almost weekly. This strike suggests improved Israeli intelligence capabilities, as Houthi leaders have historically been very hard to track.
Better intelligence, potentially shifting the dynamics there, too. And this is all happening against the backdrop of significant U.S. policy shifts, which further complicate an already volatile region.
Like what?
The Trump administration suspends visas for Palestinians is another piece of this puzzle, citing national security for new screenings.
Which visas are affected?
It affects non-immigrant visas for business, tourism, medical treatment, students, and family visits. This builds on earlier suspensions for Gaza residents and the revocation of visas for Palestinian officials, all amidst the ongoing war.
More pressure and restrictions?
Moving to Ukraine, Russia is reportedly intensifies strikes in Ukraine, expanding attacks on cities despite President Trump's deadlines for peace talks following that inconclusive Alaska summit.
So no de-escalation after the summit.
Quite the opposite. Daily drone launches nearly doubled after that summit, suggesting Russia might have slowed strikes beforehand, maybe to placate Trump, only to resume full force afterward.
And there was another high-profile death.
Yes, the former Ukrainian parliamentary leader Andrei Poruby was also tragically shot dead in Lviv, underscoring the brutality and targeted nature of the conflict. Putin continues to defy peace talks, clearly aiming to seize territory and control Kyiv, showing little inclination for de-escalation.
Beyond these geopolitical conflicts, natural disasters are also exacting a terrible toll. Hundreds were killed in a 6.0 magnitude earthquake near the Pakistan border in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan again. They've had so many disasters.
Over 800 dead reported, 2,500 plus injured, many trapped under debris in remote mountainous terrain. Rescue efforts are severely complicated by landslides and inaccessible roads, making immediate aid incredibly challenging.
And aid efforts are struggling.
Tragically, yes. The humanitarian response is hampered by steep funding cuts by the U.S. and other donors. 80 health facilities in eastern Afghanistan have closed since February, leaving a vulnerable population even more exposed.
Funding cuts having a direct, devastating impact. That's heartbreaking.
Meanwhile, in Indonesia, there's a strange disconnect. Official reports claim a flourishing economy, 5.1% GDP growth, low unemployment, low inflation.
Sounds great on paper.
But the country faces widespread protests over significant economic hardships. Economists are openly questioning the rosy GDP data, suggesting it doesn't align with the lived experience of many citizens.
People protesting despite good official numbers, that points to deeper issues.
These demonstrations, the biggest crisis for President Prabowo Subianto, escalated after the killing of a food delivery driver, leading to violent acts and looting. Adding to the pressure, a 19% Trump administration tariff is also inflicting pain on manufacturing there.
So external trade policy hitting internally.
Yes, and it's recalling past economic protests that led to major political upheaval in 1998, demonstrating the interconnectedness of global trade and domestic stability.
And even in historically stable regions like Europe, we see significant turmoil in governmental fragility. The article, "With another government on the brink of collapse, is France the new Italy?" raises a provocative question.
France, unstable like Italy used to be perceived.
It suggests France is experiencing significant fiscal and political dysfunction. Prime Minister Francois Bayrou is likely to lose a September 8 confidence vote, making him the fourth head of government to fall in just 18 months.
Four governments in 18 months. That's rapid turnover.
Very high turnover, once rare in France. It's fueled by deteriorating public finances. Debt grew massively under Macron, from $2.2 trillion to $3.3 trillion, and intense political fragmentation.
What caused the debt increase?
Macron's tax cuts without matching spending reductions, plus spending related to the yellow vest protests, COVID, and Ukraine aid have created a deep fiscal hole. Borrowing costs are rising too. France's 10-year bond yield is now above Greece's and comparable to Italy's, reflecting investor nervousness.
That's a bad sign.
And a plan to eliminate two national holidays to boost output caused public outrage, just demonstrating the political fragility and public discontent.
When we look at the larger canvas then, from ongoing conflicts to natural disasters and political instability across various continents,
these events underscore the profound fragility of global peace and the intricate interconnectedness of economies and societies. What can we learn from these diverse challenges?
And how might they shape the world you live in for years to come, influencing everything from global supply chains and energy markets to humanitarian aid efforts and diplomatic priorities? It's all connected.
Back in the U.S., the headlines reveal a persistent focus on core issues of governance and national identity, from how we vote to how we organize our military.
Right. Fundamental questions. The article, "Trump Calls for Voter Identification for All U.S. Elections," highlights a key and often divisive part of the political debate.
Voter ID again. Always a hot topic.
President Trump pledged an executive order mandating voter identification for all U.S. elections. He's also pushing for paper ballots and restrictions on mail-in voting, continuing his attacks on the election process since 2020.
Has he faced pushback on this?
Yes. This comes after a federal judge recently blocked most of his March executive order that required proof of citizenship for voter registration, which he aimed at cracking down on ineligible voters.
This brings up a crucial point about the balance of power, doesn't it? Elections are fundamentally administered by states.
Right, state control.
And the Constitution grants Congress, not the executive branch, the explicit power to change those rules. The discussion around voter ID is deeply divisive.
What are the main arguments?
Proponents cite election integrity, arguing it's essential to prevent fraud and ensure public confidence. Critics, however, argue it could disenfranchise legitimate citizens who lack updated ID or face barriers obtaining them, disproportionately affecting certain groups like minorities, the elderly, or low-income individuals.
A real tension between access and security.
We also see Trump pushing for congressional redistricting, specifically targeting states like Texas, aiming to shore up Republican majorities ahead of next year's midterms.
So shaping the electoral map, too.
This is not just about a single policy. It's about the foundational rules of our democracy and how they are interpreted and enforced, and the delicate balance between federal oversight and state autonomy in these critical areas.
And the reshaping of government goes beyond elections. There's talk of renaming departments.
Yes, the White House is moving forward with plans to rename the Defense Department to the Department of War. This is a stated goal for President Trump.
The Department of War. That's a throwback.
It is. This rebranding might require congressional action, and it echoes historical debates from 1949 when the Defense Department was established, replacing the National Military Establishment. That original move was meant to give the cabinet secretary more power and better coordinate military branches.
But it caused concern back then.
Yes, it sparked concerns about creating a military dictator at the time. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth recently stated that Defense Department just doesn't sound right, clearly aligning with the president's vision to project a more assertive posture.
A symbolic change, but potentially significant.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, at our borders, there's legal action on immigration.
Yes, a federal judge, Sparkle L. Supnanen, issued a temporary block on the deportation of Guatemalan unaccompanied minors for 14 days.
Why the block?
The judge ordered the government to confirm the children were actually deplaned and returned to the Office of Refugee Resettlement's custody. This lawsuit was filed on behalf of 10 children, but represents a putative class of hundreds after flights were apparently scheduled to depart. It highlights persistent legal challenges to immigration policy.
So what does this all mean for your rights as a citizen, the very structure of your government, and how we approach humanitarian crises at our borders?
How do you weigh the arguments between national security and executive authority and fundamental civil liberties and humanitarian concerns in these complex and often emotionally charged debates.
Each of these actions, from voter ID to departmental renaming and immigration policy, represents significant shifts in how the country defines itself and governs its people.
And the implications ripple through our society, affecting citizens and non-citizens alike.
Beyond the political and economic headlines, there are profound shifts happening in the social fabric of our nation. These stories really affect us all.
What are we seeing there?
Let's start with an article that serves as a stark warning. Black Americans are losing jobs in a warning for the economy.
A warning sign for everyone.
That's how the article frames it. Unemployment among Black Americans has risen to its highest level since 2021. Black workers, often disproportionately represented in low-skilled or junior-level jobs, are more vulnerable to layoffs and also face discrimination that unfortunately intensifies during hiring slowdowns.
And the numbers back this up.
The numbers are striking. Unemployment for Black college graduates at 5.3% in July is 1.7 percentage points higher than for white workers with only a high school diploma. That's the biggest gap since 1992.
College degree doesn't close the gap. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's wider than for less educated white workers. That's concerning.
This also coincides with federal job cuts, as Black workers are disproportionately represented in the federal workforce. The article shares the poignant story of Kenya Jenkins, 52, laid off from a Department of Health and Human Services contractor job in December. She was forced to move in with relatives and still owes $12,000 in rent.
A devastating impact.
And Kirsten Bradford, 29, with a master's degree, struggled to replace her full-time communications job. She now earns $14 an hour at Bath & Body Works, has $100,000 in student debt, and has moved back in with her parents.
Master's degree to $14 an hour. That's a tough reality. This brings up a crucial point. While overall unemployment might remain low, these concentrated job losses act as a canary in the coal mine, as Kenneth Couch, an economist at the University of Connecticut, puts it.
An early indicator of trouble.
Exactly. It's a critical indicator of broader labor market vulnerabilities and highlights persistent racial disparities in economic opportunity that become more pronounced during economic slowdowns.
And the federal job cuts play a role.
Yes. Furthermore, when the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency targets federal agencies, it has a disproportionate impact on communities that have historically found a pathway to the middle class through government jobs, as explained by Derek Hamilton of the AFL-CIO. This further exacerbates these disparities.
It's not just a statistical anomaly, it's a structural vulnerability affecting real lives.
And these challenges aren't limited to the labor market. Our population is also rapidly aging, leading to a critical social issue highlighted in the article. More older Americans are aging alone. Who will take care of them?
Aging alone. That sounds isolating.
Over 16 million Americans age 65 and older now live alone. That's 28% of that age group, nearly triple the share in 1950.
Triple the share. Why the increase?
It's driven by increased longevity, higher divorce rates, and children often being geographically scattered, unable to provide immediate support. And most are profoundly unprepared.
Unprepared how?
Only 1/4 have help for daily tasks, and over 80% haven't planned for ongoing living assistance.
That's a huge gap.
The article highlights the vital efforts of Mountain Empire Older Citizens, a nonprofit in Southwest Virginia, trying to bridge this gap. We hear about Dwayne Johnson, 73, a frozen meal delivery driver who himself works to pay medical bills.
A senior citizen delivering meals to other seniors.
Yes. He stated that a woman in her 80s told him he was the first human she'd seen in 2 weeks.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Just devastating isolation.
There's also a persistent struggle to find workers for essential roles like personal care aides, who earn a meager $12.75 an hour, and homemakers at $12.50 an hour.
Low pay for incredibly important work.
And the overwhelming needs are evident, like Kayla Mullins helping a 69-year-old man whose life completely unraveled after his wife died. This systemic challenge requires a multifaceted societal response as the burden on individuals and overstretched care systems continues to grow.
Absolutely. Shifting to another social issue, education. There's an opinion piece arguing America needs tough grading.
Tough grading, what's the argument?
It argues that rampant grade inflation, exemplified by 80% AA grades at Yale, has effectively turned students into paying customers who expect to be praised, not challenged.
Students as customers. Right. Interesting take.
Authors Solvig Lucia Gold and Joshua T. Katz recount a formative moment from their own college days, receiving C pluses on their first papers, which provided crucial, honest feedback.
So a bad grade was actually helpful.
That's their point. They argue passionately for honest assessment, stating it cultivates humility and civic responsibility. and that undeservedy mean a bad education and deprive the world of students' potential.
A strong call for a return to rigor and honest feedback to truly prepare students for life's real challenges, not just for academic accolades, makes you think about current standards.
And on a profoundly somber note, shifting to the critical issue of public safety, an opinion piece directly confronts the tragic reality of recent school violence. Remember the children of Annunciation?
Oh no, what happened?
It discusses the recent school shooting at Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis, where 2 children were killed and 18 wounded. The author, Matthew Hennessy, laments the quick normalization of such horrors and questions societal complacency.
It does feel like these tragedies become normalized too quickly. Does he offer solutions?
The article explores various proposed solutions, arming teachers, which the author rejects as creating more problems, locked gun cabinets raising new security concerns, and police officers in schools seen as a more reasonable approach.
A difficult debate with no easy answers.
It also touches on a very sensitive point, and again, we want to be clear, we are reporting the viewpoint from the source article here. It states that this bumper crop of young people who claim to be transgender are profoundly disturbed, or else caught up in a dangerous social contagion, and need immediate treatment, not celebration, and certainly not affirmation.
Okay, that's a very specific and controversial viewpoint expressed in that opinion piece. As guides to these sources, we always aim to impartially convey the ideas and viewpoints contained within the original material, providing you with the context for the discussions being presented in today's opinion pieces without endorsing or refuting them ourselves.
Exactly. These are deeply human stories that cut across demographics and generations, revealing profound vulnerabilities and urgent needs within our society.
What responsibility do we as a society have to address these disparities in the labor market, ensure adequate care for our aging population, foster quality education that truly challenges and develops individuals, and most importantly, protect our children from violence?
How do these profound challenges impact your sense of community and the future you envision for your own family? It pushes us to consider not just policy, but our collective values and priorities in building a more resilient and equitable society.
Let's dive into the fascinating currents of the business and finance world today. It's a landscape marked by both unexpected opportunities and, well, inherent risks.
Definitely dynamic. We'll start by looking at some much-needed relief for homeowners before pivoting to the volatile worlds of green tech and digital assets. The headline, "Mortgage Refinancing Starts to Thaw as Rates Trend Down," brings some positive news.
Good news for homeowners is always welcome. What are the numbers?
The average 30-year fixed mortgage rate has dropped to a 10-month low of 6.56%. This means over 2 million homeowners could now save money by refinancing, a notable increase from 1.7 million just back in July.
2 million potential refinancers, that's significant.
And if rates continue to drop and hit 6%, nearly 6 million homeowners could save at least 0.75 percentage points, which is often seen as the threshold for justifying refinancing costs.
6 million if rates hit 6%.
Okay. Emily Sisick, a 36-year-old fintech founder, for example, bought her Houston home in May 2024 at 7.375%. She's actively considering refinancing or maybe recasting her mortgage, making a lump sum payment to the principal using $50,000 from a recent property sale.
So people are actively exploring options.
Yes, and there's also an uptick in cash out refinances where people are tapping into their home equity. That suggests renewed confidence or perhaps a need for funds.
A key aspect to highlight here is how quickly sentiment can shift with even modest rate changes, and how external pressures, like President Trump's open advocacy for lower rates, might be influencing these trends, consciously or unconsciously.
Yeah, President's pressure is definitely out there.
This thaw represents a critical decision point for many homeowners, like Emily Sisick. They're weighing whether to lock in current, lower rates, or hold out for further drops, hoping for even better terms.
Gamble or lock it in.
Exactly. It also hints at a broader market recalibration after years of elevated rates, providing some much-needed relief for a sector, the mortgage industry, that has seen significant staff cuts and consolidations.
So for you, if you're a homeowner, this news could open up avenues for significant savings. It might be a good time to reevaluate your mortgage situation.
Definitely worth looking into.
From housing to transportation, we're seeing other dramatic market shifts. EV deals boom ahead of tax credit expiration tells us about a frenzied last-ditch car buying spree for electric vehicles.
Ah, the tax credit deadline effect.
Exactly. This surge is happening because the $7,500 federal tax credit is set to expire on September 30th. Dealers are offering super cheap lease deals.
How cheap is super cheap?
And a Kia, for instance, offered a Niro EV for as low as $40 a month, an EV6 for less than $100 a month, and an EV9 for just $189 a month.
$40 a month, that's practically free.
It's incredibly low. Colorado is highlighted as an EV hotspot thanks to a combination of state incentives and robust charging infrastructure, with the Nissan Ariya being a top seller there.
State incentives stacking on top.
The article shares Paul Ibarra, a 39-year-old bus driver, who explicitly stated, "There's no way I would be able to afford this car if it wasn't for the EV credits."
A clear example of the incentive driving the purchase.
This sudden surge is also leading to adjustments in production. General Motors even laid off 360 employees at a plant to reduce production of the GMC Hummer EV and Cadillac Escalade IQ, signaling an expected slowdown once the incentives disappear.
So they're anticipating the cliff after September 30th.
Looks like it.
So if you've been on the fence about an EV, this could very well be your moment to jump to take advantage of these expiring incentives.
Last chance saloon, maybe.
Perhaps. But the real question then becomes, what does this sudden boom, followed by an anticipated slowdown once the credits are gone, tell you about the true market demand for EVs without substantial government incentives?
Yeah, what's the underlying demand?
And what does it imply for the future of the auto industry, which has been pushing hard for electrification? It speaks to a market still heavily reliant on external support rather than pure consumer-driven demand. And it raises questions about the long-term viability of some manufacturers' EV strategies.
Shifting gears again, this time to an even more volatile financial arena, the headline, "Trump Family Amasses $5 Billion Crypto Fortune," is one that certainly turns heads.
$5 billion in crypto.
Wow. The Trump family has reportedly amassed this staggering fortune after the launch of the WLFI token from World Liberty Financial. That's a venture President Trump launched while campaigning, touting it to make America great again, this time with crypto.
Politics and crypto merging directly.
The WLFI token traded at a huge premium on Monday after its public debut, with an astounding $1 billion changing hands in just an hour.
$1 billion in an hour. That's incredible volume.
And the family's total crypto hoard is even larger. Trump-related entities also control around 80% of the Trump meme coin and over half of publicly listed Trump media, which runs Truth Social.
So, multiple crypto assets involved. It's a truly unprecedented intersection of politics and speculative finance.
It really is.
What's particularly striking here is the potent intersection of politics, finance, and the highly volatile, often opaque crypto market. The article highlights that actually cashing in this wealth may prove difficult due to market volatility and liquidity challenges, common characteristics of digital assets.
So it's wealth on paper, maybe hard to realize.
Could be. There's also criticism that World Liberty is a potential vehicle to influence the Trump family, with its growth allegedly propped up by partners like Binance, whose convicted founder is reportedly seeking a presidential pardon.
Ah, the Binance connection, the pardon request, that adds another layer.
It brings up a crucial point about transparency, potential conflicts of interest, and the evolving role of digital assets in political influence, especially when White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt stated, "Neither the president nor his family have ever engaged or will ever engage in conflicts of interest."
A strong denial.
But the very nature of crypto, with its decentralized and sometimes unregulated aspects, adds layers of complexity to these claims, making it difficult for the public to fully grasp the implications.
Away from crypto's wild swings, the traditional debt markets are also showing interesting, though potentially risky, trends. Junk bonds are on a tear this summer.
Junk bonds are popular again. Why?
Investors are piling back into funds that buy junk-rated corporate bonds and loans, despite elevated default rates. July saw a record $240 billion in junk-rated issuance.
Record issuance despite higher defaults. Seems counterintuitive.
This surge is largely driven by expectations of Fed rate cuts, tying back to our earlier discussion, and the simple hunt for higher yields. The average yield is around 6.75%.
Chasing yield in anticipation of rate cuts. Okay.
However, there's a significant cautionary note here. Downgrades accounted for 2/3 of S&P Global credit rating actions in the second quarter.
So underlying credit quality is actually weakening for many.
That's what it suggests. A growing divergence between investor appetite and fundamental corporate health.
This appetite for risk in the debt markets suggests a strong belief that economic conditions will improve and that the Fed will indeed cut rates, making these riskier assets, the junk bonds, more attractive due to their higher yields.
Makes sense if you're optimistic.
But the real question then becomes, What risks is your money exposed to if this optimism is misplaced, especially with tariffs potentially fueling inflation or slowing the economy, leading to more defaults than anticipated?
It's a classic risk-reward scenario, isn't it?
Very much so, but one with potentially significant downside if the market's current trajectory falters and those higher yields turn out to be inadequate compensation for the increased risk.
Even highly sophisticated and historically successful investment strategies are facing headwinds, as seen in Yale's trendsetting private equity strategy is getting harder to pull off.
Yale's endowment, David Swensen's model. That's legendary. What's happening?
Yale's private equity strategy, which yielded an impressive 13.1% annualized returns for 36 years, is now struggling. Private equity has actually lagged the S&P 500 for three consecutive years.
Lagging the S&P for 3 years? That's a big shift. Why?
Higher interest rates are actively crimping returns. And many Ivy League schools, including Yale, are now holding less than 30% in uncorrelated assets like cash, bonds, and hedge funds. That's compared to Swensen's original 30% target that famously helped weather the 2008 financial crisis.
Less diversification, less cushion. Are they selling assets?
Some schools are even resorting to selling private equity assets early at a discount just to get ahead of increased taxes on endowment investment income.
Selling early at a discount, that shows pressure. This brings up a crucial point about the long-term viability of even the most acclaimed investment strategies in a rapidly changing economic landscape.
No strategy is foolproof forever.
As Tim Sullivan, a former Yale private equity manager, notes, just because something has worked for a particular set of institutions over some period of time, it's not a guarantee of future success.
A good reminder.
It highlights how the changing interest rate environment and the increasing market concentration in tech are challenging traditional diversification principles. It's impacting major institutional investors like universities and setting a precedent for endowments globally as they navigate these new market realities.
It's a testament to the idea that no strategy, however legendary, is immune to fundamental market shifts.
In other significant market developments, gold prices hit record and overseas stocks rise.
Gold hitting records. What's driving that?
Gold prices hit a record high of $3,545 a troy ounce. It's buoyed by increased betting on a U.S. interest rate cut and fresh uncertainty around global trade following that federal appeals court ruling against Trump's tariffs we discussed.
Uncertainty driving flight to safety. Makes sense.
Overseas stocks also rose, with Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index up 2%, boosted by Alibaba's new chip news. Meanwhile, Bitcoin, interestingly, fell, showcasing divergent market reactions.
Different assets moving different ways. And on the corporate governance front,
Nestlé fires CEO over relationship with direct report. Nestlé CEO Laurent Freyssinet was dismissed over an undisclosed romantic relationship with a direct subordinate, violating the company's strict code of conduct.
A violation of conduct leading to dismissal.
Philippe Navratil, CEO of Nespresso, will succeed him. Nestlé is also facing broader headwinds from Trump's tariffs and shifting consumer preferences away from processed foods, leading to a review of underperforming brands. It shows how a global giant must adapt to both internal and external pressures.
So what does it mean when gold hits record highs amidst global uncertainty?
It often reflects investor uncertainty and a flight to safety, indicating a lack of confidence in traditional assets or the broader economic outlook.
Yeah.
Are you considering diversifying into traditional safe havens like gold as these global economic and geopolitical shifts continue to unfold?
And the Nestlé situation.
As for Nestlé, this isn't just about a corporate scandal. It highlights the increasing scrutiny on corporate governance and executive conduct, even in a company as large and established as Nestlé. It also reminds you of the ripple effect of trade policies and changing consumer tastes on even the biggest global brands, forcing them to adapt or risk losing market share.
And just briefly, a few other notable business shifts.
Sure. The UK has secured a substantial $13.5 billion deal to supply warships to Norway, strengthening regional defense capabilities. Renault is creating a chief growth officer role to revamp its business amidst fierce Chinese competition and the ongoing threat of Trump tariffs on finished foreign-made cars.
Adapting to competition and trade threats.
Showing how global forces drive corporate restructuring. And Equinor plans to subscribe for Ørsted shares in a rights issue, maintaining its 10% stake, reflecting ongoing investment in sustainable energy, particularly offshore wind.
Lots happening across the business world. Beyond the boardrooms and market fluctuations, our daily lives are shaped by culture, entertainment, and even the evolving way we consume information.
Culture matters, definitely.
And speaking of information, we're in the midst of a podcast gold rush. media companies race to license star creators.
Ah, the podcast boom continues.
Traditional media companies like Fox News, The Athletic, Vox Media, The New York Times, they're engaged in a deal-making frenzy with popular podcasters and social media influencers.
Why the frenzy now?
It seems largely driven by audiences actively seeking authenticity and unique human voices in an era where AI is rapidly changing how people consume and create information.
People want real people, especially with more AI content out there.
The numbers are clear. U.S. audiences now spend a staggering 773 million hours a week on podcasts. That's a massive jump from 170 million back in 2015.
Huge growth. What are some examples of these deals?
I see Fox News licensing Ruthless and bringing on conservative YouTuber Brett Cooper, The Athletic signing a seven-figure deal for Pablo Torre finds out, and ESPN's huge $85 million five-year licensing deal with Pat McAfee.
The Pat McAfee deal was massive.
Even as they grapple with his affinity for expletives and occasional controversies.
What's particularly striking here is the dynamic shift in media consumption, where distinctive human voices are becoming a premium commodity, almost a counterpoint to the backdrop of increasingly algorithmic and AI-generated content.
Human connection as a valuable asset.
As Paul Cheesbrough, CEO of Fox Corp's Tubi Media Group, states, the role of the creator becomes even more important. It's about breaking through information overload and capturing audiences that have drifted from traditional outlets.
And that means taking risks sometimes.
And this often means mainstream outlets are having to embrace creators with fewer guardrails than they're used to. A tension we certainly see playing out with ESPN and Pat McAfee as they try to balance authenticity with corporate standards. It suggests that even in a highly curated media landscape, the raw, unfiltered human connection still holds immense power.
It's a wild west in some ways. And it changed the landscape for talent. Speaking of traditional media institutions, ESPN employees' favorite sport, lamenting their home base, gives us a fun, surprising insight into corporate culture.
Lamenting their home base. Where is that?
Bristol, Connecticut. ESPN employees have long lamented working there, often calling it a punchline, despite it being the network's home base since 1979.
Not a fan of Bristol, huh?
Apparently not all of them. A recent closure of the L.A. Sports Center operation forced 35 staffers to either move to Bristol or lose their jobs. Fewer than half accepted the move, highlighting the perceived unattractiveness.
Wow, less than half moved.
While Bristol does offer amenities like carousel and clock museums, it's jokingly referred to as not the sexiest place in Connecticut.
Carousel museums. Okay. Yeah. Any perks?
On the upside, low rent under $1,100 a month for a two-bedroom is a definite perk. And the campus also has interesting wildlife encounters, with visits from bears, bobcats, and even angry Canada geese that employees sometimes have to dodge.
Angry geese. This article offers a delightful and surprisingly human insight into corporate culture and the subtle yet powerful influence of physical location on employee satisfaction and talent retention.
Location, location, location. Matters even for big networks.
How does a company's physical location and its perceived appeal or lack thereof influence talent recruitment and retention in your own industry or workplace? And what trade-offs are you willing to make for a dream job? Prioritizing career over geography or vice versa?
It highlights the subtle factors that shape employee experience and the decisions individuals make about their careers and lives.
Now, for a cultural phenomenon that transcends sports and business, demonstrating the immense power of celebrity influence, what Taylor Swift's love story means to her fans.
Ah, Taylor Swift, always a major cultural force.
Taylor Swift's engagement to Travis Kelce was far more than just celebrity news. For many fans, it felt personal.
Why so personal?
Bonnie Wertheim, the author, details how Swifties, who grew up with this person who was literally our friend, identified deeply with her love stories and heartbreak chronicled in her music. Her engagement represents a fairy tale ending many fans have rooted for.
A happy ending they feel invested in.
It's apparently inspiring women to ditch their unhappy relationships and hold out hope for their own fairy tale endings.
Wow. Real life impact.
And the article, Taylor Swift and Tariffs Can Both Help Sell Diamonds, also notes how Swiftonomics and the engagement news caused a surge in diamond ring searches, boosting diamond retailer stocks like Signet Jewelers and Brilliant Earth.
Swiftonomics hitting the diamond market. That's fascinating.
Here's where it gets really interesting. What explains this intense, almost communal connection with a celebrity's personal life, where her milestones become a shared emotional experience for millions?
It's a unique phenomenon.
And how does a pop culture phenomenon like Taylor Swift quite unexpectedly intersect with global economic forces like tariffs to influence something as tangible as diamond sales, impacting real-world businesses and consumer behavior?
It's a fascinating illustration of how diverse cultural and economic threads weave together in our modern world, creating unforeseen impacts that are much larger than the sum of their parts.
Beyond these broad cultural trends, the arts and entertainment world continues to offer diverse and thought-provoking
What's
experiences.
happening in the arts?
An exhibition titled All Manner of Experiments: Legacies of the Baghdad Modern Art Group at the Hessel Museum of Art explores an influential Iraqi art scene from 1951 to the 1970s.
Baghdad Modern Art. Tell me more.
This group sought to combine a nascent post-colonial national consciousness and a burgeoning modernism, blending Cubist aesthetics with Iraqi cultural imagery. The group's work was initially split between those who criticized it as elitist and those who saw it as a refreshing way forward.
Interesting mix of influences.
Highlights include poster design by Mohamed Ghani Hikmat and works by Dia Al-Azawi and Hana Malala, with a standout video piece by Sadiq Quaish Al-Faraji titled The House That My Father Built.
Sounds intriguing. What else is on the calendar?
Our arts calendar also flags a few happenings for the week of August 31st, 2025. The horror film The Conjuring, Last Rites, The Paper, an Office follow-up streaming on Peacock, various theater productions like Galas, a new album from David Byrne and Ghost Train Orchestra titled Who Is the Sky, an exhibition called Textured Stories, The Cheerman Books of Modern Japan, and the Freeze Seoul Art Market event.
A busy week for arts and culture. Any interesting books?
The opinion section also reviews Parallel Lives, Ayin Pir's biography about a captivating Cold War romance between British art historian Frances Haskell and Soviet curator Larissa Salmina, conducted through encrypted letters back in 1962, Venice.
A Cold War romance via encrypted letters.
Fascinating. And for those feeling the end of summer blues, there's a reflective letter titled Requiem for Another Summer, pondering passing seasons, retirement, and the feeling that fewer seasons are ahead than behind, as Joseph P. Petito
A
writes.
poignant thought as summer ends. And in the world of sports, big names, big money.
Always. We have the much-hyped Arch Manning, Texas quarterback, whose era began with an underwhelming debut, lost 14-7 to Ohio State, passing for only 170 yards and an interception.
Ouch. Not the start he wanted.
Despite what the article calls hysterical overreaction, historical data shows many top-rated QBs like Bo Nix and Trevor Lawrence also had rough starts but went on to successful careers, so maybe give them some time.
Good perspective. What about soccer?
Then there's Liverpool, already Premier League champions, who broke English soccer's transfer record and then did it again, spending over $500 million on new talent this summer.
Half a billion. Who did they buy?
Signed Alexander Isak for $170 million, making him the most expensive player in English soccer history, and Florian Wirtz earlier. This highlights the growing financial divide between clubs with huge profits, like Liverpool and Arsenal, and those constrained by spending rules, such as Newcastle and Chelsea.
The gap between the haves and have-nots widening.
Finally, a fascinating My Ride feature on Tosin Abasi, a progressive metal guitarist who views cars as instruments.
A guitarist who loves cars.
Deeply. He progressed through a series of high-performance cars, from a VW GTI to his current Porsche 911 GT3, which he has heavily modified and races through the canyons of Southern California. He draws compelling parallels between designing guitars and cars, emphasizing the synergy between form, function, and identity in both pursuits.
Finding parallels between music and machines. Cool.
From the deeply personal connections fans have with a pop star to the evolution of artistic movements and the thrill of high-performance machines, these stories remind you of the diverse passions and pursuits that enrich our lives.
What new cultural phenomena are you seeing emerge around you? And how do they reflect the current times and perhaps even hint at the future directions of our society? Hashtag Kagetag outro.
Wow, what a truly comprehensive and detailed deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for September 2nd, 2025.
It really was. We've journeyed from the dizzying heights of the stock market and the internal turmoil at the Fed, through the fading American dream, and into the complex world of tariffs and global power shifts, seeing how those threads are intricately woven together.
Indeed. We've seen how China's AI vision diverges from the U.S. and its profound implications, tracked ongoing conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine, and observed political and social instability from France to Indonesia.
Domestically, we've unpacked critical debates on voting rights, federal restructuring, the urgent challenges of an aging population, the crucial need for critical thinking in education, and deeply troubling concerns about public safety.
And we wrapped it up with the dynamism of the business world, from thriving EV deals and unprecedented crypto fortunes to significant leadership changes at global corporations.
Right.
All set against the vibrant tapestry of culture, including the powerful Swiftonomics phenomenon, the podcast Gold Rush, and the deeply personal stories that truly define our era.
It's a lot to take in, but hopefully you're leaving with a much clearer picture.
Absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's clear that the lines between economics, geopolitics, technology, and our individual well-being are more blurred and interconnected than ever.
They really are.
Considering all the threads we've pulled today, the market's concentration on a few giants, the geopolitical realignments forging new global power blocks, the rapid advancements in AI taking different national paths, and the profound shifts in social sentiment affecting our sense of security, what one area do you feel is most poised to redefine our future?
Good question.
To truly reshape the world you live in, say, in the next 5 to 10 years, and why? What role can you, as an informed individual, play in understanding or even influencing that trajectory?
That's a powerful thought to leave you with, and an important question for us all to consider. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you're leaving with a clearer, more nuanced understanding of the forces at play and feel much better informed.
We certainly covered a lot of ground.
Until next time, keep digging, keep asking questions, and keep being curious.
And remember, knowledge is most valuable when understood and applied. Keep seeking those multiple perspectives. Farewell.
This has been Alex Vanderbilt.
And Sam Astor.